Okay, good morning. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Johnson Shiama Graduate School of Public Policy and this our featured lecture this morning on challenges and opportunities around small modular reactors. We're very pleased to have a very distinguished panel this morning. I will introduce them in a moment, but first, my name is Jeremy Rayner. I'm the director of the Schools, University of Saskatchewan campus. We're pleased to welcome at the back Kathleen McNutt, the executive director of the school, joining us from Regina this morning. It's a great pleasure to talk on this particular topic, which has engaged attention in the province without necessarily there being any firm plans without necessarily being any firm plans for the adoption of nuclear reactors of any design in the province. But small modular reactors, which we'll hear about in a moment, have a significant number of applications which are potentially important for a small province like Saskatchewan and a province with remote northern communities and northern industries. So our panel today consists of Neil Alexander, who is the executive director of the Fedoruk Center for Nuclear Innovation. He is going to provide us with an overview of what small modular reactors are and the opportunities that there might be for adopting them. On the Neil's left, Marcel DeVos is
Senior Project Officer.
Thank you. Yeah. Senior Project Officer with the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, and as such, very much responsible for devising and implementing the regulatory approach that Canada will take to small modular reactors. And on his left is Kevin Lee, who is
Senior Policy Advisor.
Thank you. Senior Policy Advisor at the CNSC. And between them, they will talk about some of the opportunities that small nuclear reactors create for the development of nuclear regulation in Canada. At the end, I hope we'll have plenty of time for questions, and the panel has kindly agreed to take any kinds of questions that that you may have. So without further ado, Neil, if I could ask you to take
it. Thanks, Jeremy. Good morning, everyone. So when he says we'll take any kind of questions, we'd like them to be related to energy. Something along the theme of what we're going to talk about today. And so I'm going to give a bit of an introduction to the opportunities that small modular reactors create, and talk a little bit about some of the technologies that could become available in the future. And then I think CNSC, very pleased to see them here talking about the regulatory issues that and how they propose to handle those. So I think it's important to set the scene for where we are in terms of energy in the world. And I think everybody now appreciates that we know that climate change is taking place, and likely we are the cause of it, and that cause is predominantly driven by our consumption of fossil fuels to produce carbon dioxide. And for those that are in any doubt as to the situation, this year, despite the fact of the weather outside at the moment, was the warmest year on record, and the record it beat was last year. So we are seeing increasingly high global temperatures. That's not the only problem that we're facing. The change in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is credited with acidifying the oceans, and that is causing disruption in the life in our oceans. Life on land, relatively small. Life in the oceans, very, very important to the overall well-being of the planet. And that's driven by our overfishing, but also a combination of climate change and acidification, again, driven by our consumption of fossil fuels. So it's probably a good idea to get some perception as to energy flows. And this is a graph that was recently produced for the energy flows in Canada. And it shows the primary inputs on this left-hand side of the graph. And this is how it ends up being used over on the right-hand side. And it gives you some feel for the magnitude of the challenge that we face. These are our uranium, the mined uranium, and how it's used. We can see here fossil fuels in the form of primary coal, natural gas, and oil. And down here, we have wind, solar, and geothermal. So the observation that we have to have for all of the discussion that takes place about wind, solar, and geothermal, and something that we should absolutely be expanding to the maximum that we can cope with. But the challenge is enormous if we are going to replace our other energy usage. Over here, we have the outputs, and we can see here that these are the exports. And if we look carefully here, you'll see that uranium, the amount of energy that Canada exports in terms of uranium going into nuclear power stations is equivalent to the amount of energy we export in oil production and natural gas combined. And the great thing about that, two great things about that, actually. One is that is all going to CO2 emissions-free electricity production. So that's something that Canada ought to be really, really proud of and ought to be celebrating when we go to climate change conferences, because that is a contribution that we may not be making personally in this country, but that is a contribution that this country is making to the avoidance of CO2 production elsewhere in the world. The second thing that's important, given that we're here in Saskatchewan, to recognise about that figure is that all of that energy is being exported, or nearly all of that energy is being exported from this province. So Saskatchewan, for all that it's accepted being beaten up a bit recently about its reliance on fossil fuels, is actually making an enormous contribution to the emissions-free electricity production in the rest of the world. And it's something that absolutely we ought to be celebrating. So I think that's a very telling graph, and it's worth people taking that one down and understanding exactly what that's telling us about energy systems. But it only covers part of the challenge. That is in a developed country. This is a graph of world population development. And you can see here that, particularly in the developing world, populations are in the process of rising very, very quickly. And the observation to make is that over this time period that we see along the bottom here, from, say, 1850 through to the today, 2015, that yellow band at the bottom have been the people that have given rise to all of that additional CO2 production. And in the next few years, the next few decades, we need to make sure that these people are gaining the same sort of lifestyles that we have in the developed world. They want those sorts of lifestyles, they deserve them, and they're going to need energy to deliver them. So the challenge is not just replacing the fossil fuel consumption in countries like Canada, where we have the luxury of being relatively wealthy and having sophisticated grids so that we can invest in these future technologies. The challenge for the world is how do we go about bringing energy to these developing nations with very, very large populations? And they are going to want to develop. They're going to want to electrify. They need to do that if they're going to pull their people out of starvation and give them the sort of lifestyles that we are comfortable with. So in terms of energy policy, this is what worries me, that we have a rhino charging towards us, and there's lots of people out there, and you see it all the times in the newspapers, that say, well, we've got a pin, we can take the rhino down. And that's the sort of discussions that we are increasingly seeing in the world as we fail to address that incredible additional number of people that are going to want power in the near future. And it's great, we've got our pin, and then the French say they've got their pin, and the Americans have got their pin, and England's got its pin, and that way we're going to take down the rhino. And really, the challenge is much, much greater than that which anybody is getting their heads around. If you don't believe me with my sort of graphic images of the challenge that faces us, just look at the statistics. And this is a graph of energy development, so from 1993 down to through to predictions for 2020. And you'll see that fossil fuels were the backbone of the developing nations. 85% of our energy consumption was fossil fuels in 1993. For all of the discussion that you hear about renewable resources and alternative energies, the predictions are still that 76% of our energy is going to be coming from fossil fuels in 2020. The frightening thing is those pies are meant to represent the quantity of energy that's being used. So actually, you'll see there that the fastest growing in terms of additional capacity of energy use in the world remains the fossil fuels for all that we hear about the other resources that we're dealing with. This is an incredible challenge for the world to be dealing with. And we also need to be careful about how we use some of the language. Wind is undoubtedly a renewable resource, but it has effects on things that may well not be renewable. The challenge as we move our wind stations out into environments like this, away from our cities and into the hills, is that they are chopping down rare birds like eagles in increasingly large numbers. So we might have a renewable resource, but we have to start questioning some of the other things, that other effects that our other energy policies might have that may not be renewable and may be a challenge to the ongoing ecosystems within the planet. So on the other hand, what things have we seen happen in the past? So this is where the nuclear industry comes in. Ontario has built a manufacturing economy on the backbone of cheap, reliable electricity, the bulk of which has come from its nuclear power stations. About 60% of the electricity being used in Ontario at the moment comes from nuclear power. And without that, Ontario's economy would be that of a relatively poor agricultural economy rather than the manufacturing powerhouse that it is today. That is the opportunity that having plentiful energy can provide to you. The great thing about that, going back to my earlier comments, is that the clean electricity grid in Ontario is almost entirely reliant upon uranium produced in provinces like Saskatchewan. So I think, again, we can celebrate the contribution that we're making to the economy. Now, so where are we in terms of development of the nuclear industry? I think one of the important things to understand about the nuclear industry is because we build plants and they go into operation and they then last for about 60 years, the rate of evolution of the technology is relatively slow. We're not used to that nowadays. We're used to changing our cell phones every 6 months because the technology has moved along that quickly. If we had to have the cell phones that we had 60 years ago, I think we'd recognize that the technology would be a bit different in that we didn't have them at all. I'm still of an age where I can remember the first cell phone that my boss got, and it was a brick about this big with a handset on top of it. We're used to technology evolving much quicker, but the power industry, it does evolve slowly. So we had, immediately after the Second World War, the first developments of the technology and lots of early prototypes. Lots of different designs were built around the world. Out of those, we did get, unfortunately, incidents like Chernobyl from one of those very early reactor designs. We moved on to a second generation. So this is moving from our brick to still a cell phone that you couldn't carry in your jacket pocket. And those were the PWRs and BWRs and CANDUs that actually are still operating today, even though they were designed in the 60s and built in the 70s. We've progressed through generation three with increasingly developed safety systems. Some of the CANDUs that are being built are now in that generation three stage, and the reactors that are being built on the large scale reactors being built today are in what we call generation three plus, where increasing use of safety systems that do not require mankind's intervention. Mankind, unfortunately, whenever it interferes, tends to do it in an adverse way, and at least two of those incidents would not have occurred if the technology had been left to get on with it. The small modular reactors, though, are moving between the generation 3 plus sort of design and into generation 4 of revolutionary technologies. I thought I might just outline some of the sorts of things that are taking place in terms of the technology development. First of all, where do they fit into the picture? So we talked about the overall energy picture. Historically, the nuclear industry has focused on very large-scale, gigawatt-style electricity generating plants designed for sophisticated grids, designed to produce electricity as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible, as a baseload supplier to sophisticated grids. Most of the electricity in the world is produced for those grids, but most of the electricity generating plants are much, much smaller than that. So 93% are less than 500 megawatts. That's the bottom end of the existing nuclear plants. 56%, well over half, are below 50 megawatts, and 20% are less than 1 megawatt electric. They're providing electricity to not to grid applications, but off-grid applications, relatively small communities. And the industry has recognized that if it's going to make a contribution to the avoidance of carbon dioxide production across all aspects of electricity generation, then it needs to move away from just focusing on those large applications to smaller applications. And that's what a lot of these small modular reactors are being designed to address. And here are some of the applications that they use for: remote island communities where very dirty electricity generated by consumption of diesel that has to be shipped in some way is the backbone of their electricity systems. We've got mining and oil and gas production that tends to be away from sophisticated grids, again, in remote areas. And then there are a whole series of government facilities around the world that are deliberately off-grid, that are using relatively small and typically high carbon dioxide production plant. These are the opportunities for these smaller reactors to provide electricity to these environments in a reliable way. And they're no longer trying to be the cheapest. They're trying to be the most reliable and safest ways of producing electricity in those environments. So this is a picture of a Northern Diamond mine. That's the type of community that we have to be finding some way of delivering power to, and the sorts of environments that people are now considering for some of these nuclear plants. And the other challenge that we have is that carbon dioxide is not just produced by electricity generation, but it's produced by our industries, it's produced by our heating systems, and it is produced by our transportation systems. And these new reactors are also being designed with the thought in mind that they might produce more than electricity. They might produce process heat for our industries. They will produce electricity as before, but they will also be producing process heat for seawater desalination. And they might be used to run full capacity to produce hydrogen that can then be used in the transportation systems, or failing that, you could actually use that energy to produce artificial diesel and start taking carbon out of the environment in order to create fuels. I think one of the big opportunities for our northern communities is that they could also, and I've force fitted this picture into a graphic I stole from somebody else, but they can also be used to heat and light greenhouses, providing our northern communities the opportunity to have fresh fruit and vegetables 365 days of the year. So they are transformational in terms of the opportunities for their communities. This kind of availability of heat and power allows these communities to develop in the way that Ontario developed, taking them from where they are currently to creating the opportunity for them to have much more developed infrastructure. Some are developments of these smaller developments of the existing plant. So this is one of the leading lights in the US. It's basically a pressurized water reactor delivered by a being developed by a company called NuScale. The exciting thing in terms of the way it can be deployed, though, is the way the safety systems operate. As I said, they are looking at ways of taking mankind out of the equation. And the principle of the NuScale reactor is that even if left without any intervention, there are a series of intrinsic safety systems that it would go through that would allow it to move through to a point where air cooling would be sufficient to keep the fuel in a stable state over a period of time. And that as you get to that point, other systems like gravity that we can reasonably rely upon are the fundamental principle for driving the safety system. So very different to the sorts of plants that we've seen in the past where pumps, valves, human intervention was required to operate the systems and ensure that the integrity of the fuel was maintained. And there's a lot of these designs taking place. We are hosting some visits from Hitachi at the moment with some of the concepts that that they have, all driving towards this same kind of non-interventionist safety system. More radical designs, though, that move away from light water are being developed by companies like Starcore. This uses something called TRISO fuel. Here, instead of having the conventional fuel rods encased in some kind of metal enclosure, they're looking at small pellets of the uranium put inside balls of a ceramic, the outer coating of which is silicon carbide. Silicon carbide, the integrity of that remains controllable up to very, very high temperatures. It actually remains it maintains its integrity up to a temperature above that at which heat is being released more quickly than it's being created. In other words, you can never get that pellet to a temperature where the silicon carbide breaks down and the fuel is released. There are stories, and I wasn't there, so I don't know if they're true, that in China, where they have been developing a prototype of this design, they invited a lot of celebrities dignitaries to an event. They stood them next to the reactor, and they turned all of the coolant off and just said, we're now letting the thing look after itself. There's no intervention from us whatsoever. Now, I think if it did happen, it probably wouldn't be licensed in Canada. We can perhaps have CNSC comment on that. But it's a very powerful example of the type of concepts that are going into these modern technologies that allow them to be located in our communities or not far from the communities and to produce heat and power to drive those communities. That is far from the only design. This is another company, a Canadian-based company, that's developing a molten salt reactor. Here, the fuel is actually already in a molten salt, and it's designed to run that way. The salt has a very high vapor pressure, so basically you can't drive the salt to a point where it's breaking down. And again, a non-interventionist approach to managing safety. So allowing it to potentially to be located much closer to our areas of population. And a lot of these designs have been used before. So the molten salt reactor was actually designed to go into planes. And here is a picture of a plane that flew with a reactor on board 47 times. And there's the engine that they were hoping to hook it up to. It never actually flew under its nuclear power, but they demonstrated the concepts. Then they realized that it wasn't really a very good idea. So moved on to other ways of using nuclear power more constructively. More radically, this is a Vancouver-based company that's getting into the nuclear industry, and here they're developing a fusion concept for a small modular reactor. This would radically change our approach to energy in the world, and if these people are successful in Vancouver, then we could guarantee the energy security of the world indefinitely. So it's a very powerful opportunity. Has some way to go, but they are very confident and they are gaining funding for the development of that technology. And the opportunity as these technologies develop could come to Canada if we're an early mover in the business. Some of these companies are actually based in Canada doing their developments, Terrestrial Energy and General Fusion, both Canadian-based. There are other Canadian companies in there. Others have started developing their supply chain or already have their base. But if Canada was an early mover, that would encourage that business opportunity to come to Canada. And there is still plenty of opportunity as these companies develop their supply chains. So we're doing some work here. We're encouraging the creation of the Canadian Institute of Science and Innovation Policy to look into some of the issues around understanding how nuclear power might fit into the picture. So from an engineering and a technology point of view, we know what the developments are, but there are also social and policy impacts, and we're investigating some of those. And I think possibly for the first time in the nuclear industry, starting to listen to what people want so that we can develop a position that is appropriate to meeting their needs rather than just telling them what they want. So I'm using this quote as a sort of byline, since in order to speak, one must first learn to speak by listening. So that's a large part of what we're looking to do with the school here in terms of understanding how nuclear may fit into the picture as we move forward. And this is some work that was sponsored by the Fedoric Centre, undertaken by the University of Saskatchewan, to listen to what people of Saskatchewan were actually saying. And this is the question here was about the overall impression of nuclear power in Saskatchewan. And actually, we find that it's a province that largely feels that it understands the issue, and the vast majority of people are mainly positive. Although that vast majority of people that are mainly positive don't tend to make their views known, whereas this small group of people down here that are entirely negative tend to be very vocal and get their say much more than the majority do. That's clearly something that we need to do some work on. Thought I'd finish just by talking about used fuel, because that always tends to come up, and it's known as the Achilles heel of the nuclear industry, and it's one that we have struggled to explain to people. But if we go back to my introduction about the challenges that the world faces in terms of CO2 production, and then ask ourselves how many people that we know have had their lives in some way adversely affected by our management of used fuel, you'll find that you can't find anybody, I think, in Canada. And possibly, if you ask the question that way, you can't find anybody in the world that can genuinely say that their life has been adversely affected by the management of used fuel. We have been managing used fuel effectively and very safely since the start of the nuclear industry, and there is no reason why we should not continue to do so. Yes, it has some challenges associated with it, but compared with the immediate challenge that we face of how we produce emissions-free electricity for the world, it is a relatively minor challenge. And I think one of the other things that I always like to finish my presentations with is to make people aware of just how much nuclear technology is in their everyday lives. I've used this slide in the past, but I now prefer to do a walk through a normal day of my own life, where I wake up, I step out of my bedroom door into a corridor where there is a smoke detector. That smoke detector contains an americium-241 source. It's a radioactive source. It is such a contribution to human health and safety that we are mandated to have those detectors in our houses. As I walk further down that corridor, there is a compact fluorescent bulb that has a krypton 85 starter in it. Again, we are using those because of their environmental benefits. As I get into my car, I have an engine that operates more efficiently because neutron sources were used to image the oil flow within the engine and to investigate the surface coatings that are used to extend the life of that engine. And as you go through the day, you will continue to experience the contributions that the nuclear industry has made to our everyday modern society. So this one's titled is Making Us Safer, Healthier and Happier. I actually would say that we couldn't run the modern society that we do today without the contribution that the nuclear industry in some form or another has made to our everyday lives. I think that's a very positive note on which I'd like to finish. Thank you very much.
So thank you for coming out today and braving the weather. This is a two-part presentation. I'll first give you an overview of the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, what it's about, and then my colleague Marcel DeVos will give you the interesting part of the presentation, which is a little bit about SMRs. So Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission was established in the year 2000. However, it was predated by the Atomic Energy Control Board, and that was established in 1946. Now, what many people may not know is that the second self-containing nuclear reaction in the world actually happened in Canada. And it was at the University of McGill and in Montreal in 1946. So in terms of what we do, we regulate all nuclear-related activities in Canada. We're one of the few nuclear regulators in the world that actually covers all activities. In terms of our mandate, as I said, we regulate all activity in Canada. We also implement Canada's international agreements on the peaceful use of nuclear energy. We have our nuclear... Too quiet, or...? We have the mandate to implement Canada's international obligations on the peaceful use of nuclear energy. So non-proliferation is very big in what we do. And we also have the obligation to disseminate objective, scientific, technical, and regulatory information. So much of what we do is a lot of outreach. We have a program called CNSC 101, where we go out to communities and we explain what the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission does, what its responsibilities are, and how it operates. I should point out, though, that we have no mandate whatsoever for social license. That's entirely up to the proponents. That's entirely up to government to decide. Our job is to make sure that when someone wants a licensee, a license to conduct a nuclear activity, that in our opinion, it's being done safely. So if safety is the biggest thing that we look at, how do we do it? We do it through setting requirements. There's regulations, and if you want, there's some thumb drives at the back that have our regulations on it, so feel free to pick one up. It also has our reg docs. Reg docs are the guidance and the requirements that we impose on licensees to help them operate in a safe manner. So we're very concerned about protecting all workers in the nuclear industry, obviously very concerned about protecting the Canadian public, and as well, we also have a mandate to protect the environment within Canada. In terms of our international commitments, we participate in a wide range of international undertakings. We're very active on the IAEA, which is the International Atomic Energy Association. We also partake in the International Commission on Radiation Protection. So anything that evolves and has anything to do with nuclear in Canada, be it nuclear medicine, be it portable gauges that are used in the oil fields, nuclear reactors, accelerators, general fusion, all of those activities are all regulated by the CNSC. And we're a little bit different in terms of how we regulate. other nuclear regulators, what they will do is they will regulate based on, let's say, the certification of a design, or they'll regulate a facility. We regulate activities. So there's a small nuance there, and it's a slight difference in the policy approach that we take as a regulator. Disseminating information, very unique for a nuclear regulator to have that mandate. And it is part of our mandate. It is in our act. It is something that we are obligated to do by the Government of Canada. So because of that, we do research on a wide range of topics. We commission health studies. We publish health studies on our website. We publish and share all of our regulatory documents. We also consult extensively anytime we put forward or amend a regulation. One of the things that we do quite frequently are discussion papers or white papers. And we started that probably 4 or 5 years ago, and we're very active in that. Some of the recent discussion papers we've had out are on financial guarantees. So if a licensee were to go bankrupt, all CNSC licensees have to put aside money to ensure that if they're out of the picture, that there is funds there to safely remediate the area. We've also done them on effluent and release limits. So engaging with the public and other stakeholders as well as licensees as to what the level should be that they're allowed to release, because sometimes you do need to do releases and you will get very, very small releases, usually less than background radiation, I should add. We've done discussion papers on our regulations. Marcel and I are currently working on a discussion paper on small modular reactors that will be published probably January, February. And what we will do is we'll put that out for 120 days. The public is more than welcome to comment on it, and we do receive quite a few comments. And all those comments are taken into consideration and accounted for as we move forward and determine how we're going to regulate in a given area. So I've talked about the fact that we regulate all of the nuclear cycle. So we do uranium mines and mills, fabrication and fuel facilities, waste management facilities. So all of the talk about a DGR, once that DGR, the Deep Geological Repository, comes to fruition and the site is determined, we will be the regulator who will regulate that. We also regulate nuclear substance facilities, industrial and medical applications. So anyone who's had any type of intervention or diagnostic through nuclear medicine, we regulate that. We also regulate all the research facilities, such as your slowpoke here at the University of Saskatchewan. And we export and import and control how the nuclear substances are imported and exported. So back to our mission. It's to protect the health, safety, and security of persons and the environment, to implement Canada's international commitments on the peaceful use of energy, so non-proliferation, and to disseminate objective, technical, and regulatory information to the public concerning the activities of the Commission. Now, the Commission itself is an independent body appointed by the government in council. It's a quasi-judicial administrative tribunal, so basically almost like a court of law, and the Commission members are independent. All of our hearings are public, and if we were to, let's say, do an extension of the Darlington license of the nuclear power plant in southern Ontario, the hearing itself would take place in the community. So it allows those locally affected to actually intervene and give their opinions on what's occurring. Again, though, the Commission makes a determination as to whether or not the activity being proposed by the licensee is safe, not whether or not it has a social license. And that Commission is supported by a secretariat and independent legal service, so independent from both the staff at the CNSC and independent from the government as well. And any decision made by the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission itself can only be reviewed by the federal court. The federal government cannot overturn a decision made by the Commission. In terms of where we're located, well, we have just under 800 employees. We have a number of regional offices, including one in Saskatoon. We also have site facilities where we are actually on site with major operators. So Chalk River, where the NRU is and where isotopes are made, we actually have an office there, as well as at all the existing power plants in Canada. In terms of how we report, we report to the government through the Minister of Natural Resources. We do not report to the minister, but we need some vehicle by which we can actually table our annual report, for instance, with the government, and all of that is done through a minister. So the minister is not allowed to actually change anything that we send in. but he's merely the vehicle through which we do that. And this is my last, second last slide. I should add that the commission determines whether or not they think it is reasonably expected that the licensee will operate in a safe manner. And based on that, they then make their decision. So once they've made that decision, before they make that decision, there's a number of ways that occurs. Staff will obviously have a submission that goes into the commission and they will present in front of the commission. The proponent or the licensee will also do a submission. And then anyone else who wants to intervene is allowed to do so. We have participant funding, so if someone or an organization feels they have a vested interest in this, but they don't necessarily have the resources to attend a meeting, we actually provide funding so that they can appear. We don't always give the funding, but if a good case can be put forward, funding is provided to actually address the commission. And in terms of the commission and staff, there's actually a line between the commission and the staff. All staff interaction with the commission is through the secretariat. So the secretariat is the body that actually is the buffer, in essence, between staff and the commission members. So what that means in reality is that the staff at the CNSC don't have any other special relationship or ability to communicate with the commission than either a licensee, a proponent, or even a member of the public, or in any other intervener. So there's no special privilege associated with being on staff. You're there to give them your opinion, to give them the scientific information, but at the end of the day, the commission is an independent body, independent of government, independent of staff, and independent of licensees, who make a determination as to whether or not any proponent will actually get a license to conduct a nuclear activity. So I've given you a very broad, a very quick overview of what the CNSC is about. Marcel will now get into the specifics about SMRs.
So thank you, everyone, for inviting the CNSC here to come and speak with you about small modular reactors. I could probably spend a whole day talking about the technologies, but I'm restricted to about 15-20 minutes, the way I see it right now, so I'll just get to it. My background originally is, I'm a senior project officer in the new major facilities licensing division. Our division is responsible for the project management of licensing a new nuclear facility in Canada, whether it be a large nuclear power plant, whether it would be a small modular reactor, and possibly even new research reactors should they come in. I come from an original background. I've worked in the high-tech sector, but I've also spent 14 years of my life in one of the larger nuclear power plants that was actually up in one of the diagrams earlier, the Bruce plant, as a test engineer, so I'm quite familiar with how the plants actually function and some of the safety issues that go into the design and operation of one of these facilities, which has come in quite useful in a discussion on small modular reactors. So I'd like to start with a very simple slide in the beginning, because one of the most interesting things about the whole SMR phenomena is that we've not seen any consensus develop around the world as to exactly what is an SMR. So from a regulatory perspective, I can basically say to you that they remain as standard fission reactors. They share a lot of common attributes with the larger power plant cousins, and in that they still have a controlled fission reaction in them, with, of course, a release that could occur if an accident were to happen, which is what we call a source term. What makes them slightly different, and I'm going to get into what the differences mean very shortly, is that they're proposing different ways of constructing and operating these plants. So the designs are designed, for example, along the lines of shipbuilding, which will use modularity. Anybody who's looked at how modern ships are constructed, you actually build large portions of the ship off in a factory and deliver the entire chunk of the vessel to the build site and start attaching things together and doing commissioning. That's proven to be very efficient in that industry, so they're going to give it a try in nuclear to try and reduce the amount of impacts on the construction project itself, where delays tend to occur. They're also proposing a significantly greater use of automation as well as instrumentation and control. And the point there, they're trying to make a case to use less people in the plant where possible. There's part of its economics. Part of it also is from a human factors perspective. They're trying to reduce the human error in the equation.
and that remains to be seen how that's going to work. They're proposing, as you said earlier, greater use of passive and inherent safety features. I'll get into what some of the implications are about that. There's multiple end uses, so what these plants are being used for is going well beyond the traditional electricity, which has been dominant in the market. And one other thing that's important with small modular reactors is they may be sited in places where a nuclear power plant never would have thought to have been put in the past. So what you'll see in the three circles is there seems to be different groups of SMRs. Some of them are the more the larger ones that are more well known around the world are in the 100 to 300 megawatt range. They might be a little bit more, but that seems to be what's commonly understood to be a small modular reactor. We're also seeing a growing number of vendors developing technologies in the 3 to 40 megawatt range, and these are for off-grid use. Or in some cases, for example, the Russians are developing a floating power plant that you can actually station offshore from a remote site and connect to a local grid. And then you can't discount research reactors. We cannot predict what kind of research reactors might be built in the future. Generally, they will follow the very same types of processes that are being considered for small modular reactors, from construction approaches to instrumentation. So these are things that we as a regulator have to keep in mind, because our goal is to understand what requirements, safety requirements, need to be applied to these types of reactors in order to ensure that they are operated safely. So to give you an idea, Neil gave you a couple of examples of designs. So what I want to do is, it's not so much on the designs themselves that I'm going to speak, but what they represent. So small modular reactors on their own, I've already said, they're not that different from their cousin in that they do still have a fission reactor, but they bring different technological approaches to the table that may not be very well understood, or more research is required in order to understand the implications to safety. So I'll give you on the left. The left is a twin unit B&W M-Power reactor. Each of the reactors is in the center of the domed building that you see on the diagram. Each one of those would have been capable of producing about 200 to 225 megawatts electric per unit. What makes this plant interesting is that the entire structure is located below grade or below ground. So that raises some interesting questions, for example, on the use of civil codes and standards. We need to understand what are the aging implications on a below ground building. Right now, we have a very good understanding of how to inspect concrete structures that are above ground for wear and tear over a 60-year lifespan. Are the building codes sufficient to actually to cover off aging mechanisms when they're located below ground and in contact with a fairly harsh chemistry environment from their surrounding soil and rock? Another design is the Carry Smart reactor. That one is a fairly standard 100 megawatt size SMR. It is very similar in size to an old plant that's on the Bruce site in Ontario called Douglas Point, which was one of the first reactors built in Canada to commercially produce electricity. So in that particular design, they're proposing a number of passive features. It's been reviewed by the Korean regulator. If they were to come to us, we would have some questions to ask about the passive safety features and how well they're being defended. Neil introduced the concept of a new scale design on the left. What makes this reactor interesting from a technological and engineering perspective is here you have this is one of the first reactors where you're actually submerging the entire reactor vessel and number of them in a common heat sink pool. That pool is your emergency heat removal system for the plant if accidents were to occur. So for us, we would like to understand how accidents from multiple units would progress through the facility, and whether or not that pool, how it would sufficiently remove the heat from an accident scenario, even if you were able to shut down the reactor safely. So we would be looking as a regulator for evidence that they have considered all of these things. What also makes this type of design interesting is when they do a fuel replacement of the reactors, they will literally use a crane in the facility, which is shown in the cross-section there, to lift the reactor vessel out of its cell, move it to the refueling section of the plant, and then take the whole reactor apart. This is the first time that I've seen such a concept being tried out, so there will be safety implications for doing that as well. What kind of code would you use for the crane to confirm that, what's going to happen if you drop the reactor? Okay? We want to see what safety is in place to prevent that from occurring. The reactor on the right is currently being built in China. It's called the High Temperature Reactor Pebble Bed Module, or HTRPM. What makes this reactor a very interesting design is that it is the first plant in the world that you will have one control system controlling two reactors at exactly the same time and providing heat from both of those reactors to common process systems. So there are reactors in other parts of the world where you'll have one reactor supplying to two, three, four turbines. But this is the first time that this has happened the other way around. So the whole concept of controlling two sets of reactions at the same time in tandem with one another is an interesting technical issue. And there, we have to look at how requirements would be applied to that case. So when Neil was talking about conventional grids, these are the standard grids that we go home to every night where we flick our switches. We know there's a giant grid all around us ready to supply power, and there's a whole number of different power supplies that are coming into it, whether renewable, whether nuclear, whether coal. So the certain we have been contacted by a number of companies for information that want to develop designs specifically to service this market. So just to give you an idea of what we as a regulator have to prepare ourselves for, we've been contacted by water-cooled reactors with more traditional types of designs, whether light water or boiling water, pressurized water or boiling water reactors. But we're also being approached by companies that are advocating molten salt, sodium fast reactor, lead-cooled, which uses molten liquid lead as a coolant rather than water, and high-temperature gas, which uses helium and what was described as TRISO fuel, okay, which is a block of carbon or balls of carbon impregnated with small amounts of fissile material. So what's important to understand, many of these companies will advertise our designs are inherently safe or it's impossible to have an accident. Well, as a regulator, our job is to challenge those claims. In the end, when you put a whole bunch of these units together, and you might build a plant that has four, five, or in the NuScale design, up to 12 units, you have a sizable inventory on the site. That if a certain type of accident were to occur, the source term would be equivalent to what you'd see from one large nuclear power reactor if an accident were to occur. So there needs to be an understanding of what the safety implications are of that as well. Then we move on to this smaller SMRs that would be used for edge of grid and off grid. So this is called a Gen 4 facility. It's one of the only actual diagrams I can pull off the web that actually shows what a power plant would look like. Neil showed you the star core unit, which everything is inside as opposed to here where everything is outside. So there have been in the distant past efforts to develop on-site off-grid power. It has been done. They've built it on ships. They've located them in Greenland. They've located them in the Antarctic on a very small scale, but usually run by the military. So these are the first truly civilian applications that are being developed for use in the far north. And this example here would use what's called a lead bismuth fast reactor. So to give you an idea of scale of the reactor, the reactor core itself would be not much taller than I am, so I'm about 6 feet tall, and, well, a lot wider than me, but anyways, about that wide. So it gives you an idea that the size of a core for this type of facility would be significantly more compact from something that you're used to right now. And the general approach is they're planning to put them in underground silos. These types would also have longer refueling outages. And one of the more interesting things is some of these designs are actually intended to be transportable cores. So they would be factory fueled and delivered to the site as a sealed unit. The reason for that is in moving it to a site and putting it into service there, they're removing safeguards issues. If you have no access to the fuel, you can't tamper with the reactor. But it does present transportation issues, which of course will play a role in public acceptance. So some of the companies that have approached us, so new tiny power reactors are relatively new to us as well. However, the fundamental principles continue to apply. We've been approached again, molten salt, a sodium fast reactor, lead and lead bismuth reactors, and high temperature gas reactor companies. So there's an aggressive amount of effort being made by companies to develop and promote their technologies. And as a regulator, our job is to at least anticipate and be prepared with the right requirements to be able to regulate these technologies and how they're used. What's interesting about these, I've already talked about transportability. These are the most likely, the smaller ones are most likely to be put through multiple uses. So if you put one in a northern town, you're likely going to, the proponent is likely going to take advantage of the waste heat coming out of the reactor and use it for district heating if it's economical. He mentioned growing food, so you could use condenser heat, which is normally just waste dumped into the air or into the water. That heat could be used for greenhouses. So again, we need to look at how the reactor is being used and what that actually means for the public. The hazards, by the way, of a tiny reactor, you may be dealing with a tiny core, but once again, the hazards can be quite significant. You're still dealing with radioactive materials. So what I was trying to get to the point on is, what is it that makes SMRs different from the traditional nuclear power plants? The root of the discussion from a regulatory perspective are the novelties or the new things that they bring to the table. And in the nuclear industry, which is highly conservative, the idea of novelty is again, why is it a changeless or very slowly changing industry? It's because things have to be proven, very well proven, before they're accepted for use. When you need to put a safety case forward to say, I can operate this thing safely, we need to understand why. And it's not just the regulator, it's the public that needs to understand that. And a strong utility also wants evidence that the plant will operate and perform exactly as it was specified. So there are new technologies being used in a facility. There could be 20, 30 different novel approaches used in a typical design. And all of these novelties add up. And with each novelty, you have uncertainties that come with it. And uncertainties require research and development activities in order to support the concept and its safety approach in general. So some activities, the way they might run the nuclear power plant, ownership models, operational models, can challenge existing licensing and operational models and approaches. We're used to dealing with a utility in a certain way. What happens if the utility proposes to operate these plants in a different way? What does that mean? And that's something that we as a regulator have to be on top of at all times. We have to understand what approaches ahead of time might present policy issues. What you don't want to get into as a regulator is that somebody comes in with a license application and, well, we're going to have to put this on hold because for the next 5 years we're going to have to develop a public consensus on a particular technical approach. So our job ahead of time, and we've been doing this for the last few years, is to anticipate these issues. And part of what the SMR discussion paper will be bringing out in around the end of January are some of our high-level thoughts about areas where more work will be needed in industry discussions with the public. And all of this is being done because in the end, we as a regulator have to make sure that our requirements and guidance are clear and can be applied to all the different possible scenarios that can be done, and that's quite a challenge. And we have to understand where clarifications need to be made. It's not our job to analyze the technologies and say, okay, we need to tweak this requirement here or the guidance here. We're actually looking for industry and the public to come and engage with us in that conversation and say, here's where we need to see changes made in order for this to work. So, of course, understanding what an SMR is represents has shaped our readiness preparations. One of the things we've discovered, we've traditionally been a can-do regulator, but we also have had a fairly large fleet of research reactors in the country. We've regulated mines and mills for many years, is we have actually, we're very well prepared from our regulatory framework perspective. A lot of our requirements are already set in a very technology-neutral manner, so they can be interpreted in the face of any technology that comes in. We keep things fairly high level. And what technology neutral means is that, for example, our requirements, which are the shalls, the things that you must do, and our guidance are generally not focused on can-do technologies. So you will not see can-do very specific things. There are exceptions, for example, in CSA standards, where there are specific can-do applications that need specific standards, and that's okay. Our guidance, so when you set shalls, things that you must do when operating, constructing and operating a power plant, we also provide guidance. And what the guidance is there to do is to talk about what we call graded application of requirements. So what that means, I'll explain shortly what the graded approach is. It's using risk-informed methodologies to interpret what the requirement means and therefore what the course of action, how you will design the plant, will depend on the level of risk presented. And of course, our job in our regulatory documents is to push very strongly for a proponent to supply supporting evidence that's based on sound science and engineering practices. So we're looking for calculations, analyses, regulatory research, experimental work, that kind of things, to support a claim. In anticipation of new build projects, we've developed documents called... I'm getting ahead of myself here. We have a licensing process in Canada, which is also not technology specific. It's technology neutral. It doesn't care about the size. It doesn't care about the technology. The process is focused on the public side of things and on the fact that we're licensing activities rather than technologies. So our licensing process for nuclear power plants, which would include SMRs, research reactors, as well as mines and mills, is covered off in regulatory document 3.5.1, which can be found on our website. It explains things like mandated timelines, for example, for the performance of an environmental assessment. And just to give you an idea of rough timelines, if you're building a first-of-a-kind large power plant or large SMR, power output doesn't matter, it's more about the project itself. From the time you apply for an environmental assessment and the first license, which is to prepare the site, which is acceptance of the site suitability, until the time you get your operating license granted by the commission would take approximately 9 years. A vast majority of that is spent in public process, and also because the licensee has to put together their safety case, which can be a very complex task. A very small reactor that would be used up in the north would take about 6 to 7 years to go through the public process. And of course, we've actually opened the door in our discussion paper that if people see a need for an alternative licensing process, we're open to listening to safety arguments around that. Economics is not part of the discussion for us. It's all about coming across from a safety perspective. Okay, so... So to enable an efficient application for a license, we have started putting together what are called license application guides. These will suggest the format and information that we are looking for a successful license application. So what exactly are we looking for in the overall safety and environment case for a project? This document speaks to that. But its job is also, these must be worked in concert, done in concert with using our regulatory documents, which contain all the technical shalls and shoulds that are needed when proposing a technology. So how to do safety analysis, how to do design, how to think about decommissioning, how to consider emergency planning, all of those are in our regulatory documents. This tells you how to arrange it all into a useful application for discussion with the public. Some of the things that affect licensing timelines, and this list that I have here before you has come out from operating experience. So we've been watching new build projects happening around the world, and actually what you'll find is that this list is not much different if you are building a new dam or if you're building another large civil structure project. The rules are exactly the same. Is the license application complete? Does it have all the supporting information that it needs to proceed with the process? Is there stakeholder support? Okay, so the licensee or the applicant for a license has to do their homework well in advance with their communities to build support for the project and be prepared to engage with those who are not for the project and do it in a respectful manner. The CNSC will be looking for that. But if the licensee does not do that, then they will run into problems in the licensing process. For example, legal reviews will be triggered. They'll take the CNSC to court, for example, based on their decision. State of completeness of a design. It does no good for you to come with a concept to us. We can't license the operation of a paper reactor. I can't say that bluntly enough. And there's a number of the SMR companies. Some of them have gone a long way in developing their technologies. Other ones have done an excellent job of marketing, but really haven't got any technical substance yet. Novel features or approaches, I've already talked about that. If you're going to try something new, please be prepared to defend it with real hardcore research and development to demonstrate it is as good as other concepts that are tried and true already in our industry. That's why it's changeless, because if things work, If it ain't broke, don't fix it is a typical mantra in the nuclear industry. Is your supporting R&D in good shape? Do you have outstanding experiments that you still need to do to prove the case? So, for example, it is possible to build a small power plant as a demonstration unit, but roll the remaining R&D work into that facility. What we will do is build a license around it, taking any additional risks into account. Then there's quality and timeliness of construction and commissioning, which to me has been the biggest Achilles heel of any large civil project. Is if you run into quality assurance issues in the project, it's going to grind everything to a halt, and almost every large project, whether nuclear or non-nuclear, has run into issues here. So we're committed to meeting timelines, the government-mandated timelines. We also set our own performance standards, but the applicant has to be well prepared to engage. It really defaults on them to do a really, really good job and assume responsibility for the project. Talk a little bit about what the graded approach is. This is a term that is often mentioned in discussions around small modular reactors. The concept of the graded approach are methods, or think of a toolbox that contains a whole series of tools to make risk-informed decisions. Okay, you might use probabilistic analysis, you might use what they call deterministic analysis, you might use engineering judgment, which is a whole group of people with a lot of knowledge to come to a decision. So this toolbox contains methods used to establish the stringency of design measures, safety analyses, and how you're going to operate the facility commensurate with the level of risk posed by the reactor facility. And what's very important to include in this risk discussion is reactor power, the characteristics of the reactor, what is the maturity of the fuel design, what kind of source terms or releases can you get in an accident, what's the enrichment of the fissile material that could be used. Some of these small modular reactors, the smaller ones, are looking at enrichment that stays just shy of 20%, which is quite a bit higher than the 0.7% used for CANDU to 4 or 5% used for a light water reactor. What are you using the reactor for? And putting that right next to it is the next bullet below. If you put it beside an oil refinery or a liquefied natural gas facility, you need to consider the total risk. The nuclear power plant may actually prove to be less of a risk than the facility sitting next to it. That facility may actually have a fire or an explosion or an accident that could potentially affect the safety case of the nuclear power plant that you have next door. That's part of the safety discussion. What kind of features are you using to ensure safety, and how much do you know about it? And then, of course, where are you going to put it? So it could be putting it closer to a city, which, of course, has impacts on things like, well, do you need to evacuate in the event of an accident? Or can you actually prove that evacuation will never be necessary? But on the other side of things, if you go up into the deep Arctic, it could take you a week to respond to a reactor accident because you have to fly resources up there if you're in a village of 500 people in the middle of wintertime in a massive storm. So the design then has to take that into account and be prepared to be able to sit quietly for a week in an accident state and not release anything to the public or trigger other activities for emergency planning. So the whole concept of graded approach in the event is one thing that's important. We've heard from some of the vendors, they talk about relaxing requirements, and I think that's actually a dirty way of saying it. You're not relaxing the rules. You are risk-informing interpretation of the rules. You're not relaxing the rules. It means that the solution that you choose fits the risk profile. And an example I will give you is we are currently have slowpoke reactors and we have large nuclear power plants. Both of them have containment systems. The slowpoke containment system is an industrial building with a really nice ventilation system. That is suitable containment for that reactor. For a large power plant, you'll have a heavy concrete steel containment building, which is suitable for the higher energy output and heat that that type of reactor puts out. Both of them meet containment requirements, which are exactly the same. Okay, so that gives you an idea of risk-informed or application of the graded approach. So some examples of CNSC requirements that can already be applied to SMRs. If you go onto our website under regulatory framework, you will find a whole number of regulatory documents with requirements and guidance. And we've gone through many of these. We feel they can easily be applied to small modular reactors as they are. They all provide an allowance for the use of the graded approach, risk-informed application of requirements, and we allow for what we call alternative approaches. So if you feel as a proponent that this requirement really does not fit this application, because, for example, I have a liquid fuel reactor rather than a solid fuel reactor, we have provisions available for you to make a safety-based argument on what an alternative approach to safety might be. So, getting on quickly before I finish off, we are working on a small modular reactor discussion paper. You've already mentioned that it's looking to be released sometime in January of next year. In writing this paper, we're not focusing on speaking directly to the nuclear industry. We had to consider a very wide variety of people that might be interested in what small modular reactors represent and how they might be regulated. So we're considering the public at large. In other words, this is an opportunity for us to explain how certain areas of SMR might be regulated. Existing licensees with an interest in this area. We also have a large number of companies from outside Canada that don't understand the regulatory approach in Canada. Every country you go to has a different way of regulating. And it's very important to get the mental model right with them when they come in the door. And that's part of dissemination of information, is explaining exactly how things work in Canada. We have government agencies, whether provincial, territorial, or federal, that have an interest in this new energy source and what that means and when would they ever go about making decisions around deployment of them. We have educational and science and technology institutions that have an interest in some of the issues raised. And of course, foreign nuclear regulators in other countries, not necessarily, for example, the US, which has a very mature regulatory system, but we see countries like Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, that are starting nuclear programs up, that are saying, how do we develop a technology-neutral approach to regulation? So they're interested in this stuff, and it's actually free lessons learned for them. We're going to speak to how we would address licensing if somebody were to come with an application tomorrow. It's one thing to anticipate what the future might look like, but hey, if somebody brings an application to us right now, how would we deal with it? So we will talk about that there. We'll also talk about, when you read about small modular reactors, people have brought up issues. One issue that I'll talk about, for example, is, well, how would you go about licensing a large plant that has many reactors in it? And I'll explain very shortly in another slide. For us in Canada, we already do that with the large power plants, and we're one of the only countries in the world that does it that way. Most countries, they actually, when you build a multiple reactor power plant, they license each individual reactor by a separate process. We have one license around the entire because it involves activities done by the same company. We're going to discuss how some of these issues are already being addressed in our framework. Of course, we're going to be inviting comments if people disagree or would like to see changes. We want to identify how some of these international challenges might be different in Canada from a Canadian perspective. And we're going to be asking in every case for feedback or thoughts. And this could be thick proposals. Industry may come to us and say, we'd like to take a position on this. That's okay. We're open to listening.
So if we could have some time for questions.
Yes, almost done. So I will skip the next slide. What will the feedback be used for? We're going in front of our commission in April of next year. We're going to be providing them, at their request, some information on SMR activities, and there will be a public discussion about that. Industry will be coming in front of us to speak as well. What we're going to be doing is using the feedback from this paper to make decisions about how the regulatory framework might change in the coming years to adapt to these technologies. And, of course, it will influence our regulatory research program. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for your attention. Sorry for taking so long. It's hard to be slow but clear and tell the whole story. Thank you.